Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
With Vodafone. Showcase your business at the Aviva this November with Vodafone's See Your Business Pitch Side Competition. See vodafone.ie/business.
This is News Talk.
Yeah, you're very welcome to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up over the next hour, we'll take a closer look at the new iPhone 17 lineup. Is it jaw-dropping design or just another missed opportunity? I'll take you inside Aon's Centre for Innovation and Analytics to learn how they're using data and AI to inform the insurance risks of those with large portfolios ranging in billions of dollars of property against natural disaster and even cyber attacks. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Instagram @JessKellyNT. But I want to start this week with Apple because their September event is always a big date in the diary and it is now coming on for 2025. And while some of the headlines focused on the awe-dropping tagline, the substance of the launch was a little bit more nuanced. And today we're going to look at the key announcements. What did they announce and what was missing?
Good morning. Welcome to Apple Park.
iPhone 17 has a beautiful, more durable design and comes in five gorgeous colors. Lavender, mist blue, black, white, and sage. The new design has a larger 6.3-inch display with thinner borders, so you can see more and do more.
We have four new iPhones. There's the iPhone 17, the 17 Pro, 17 Pro Max, and the brand new, definitely intriguing 17 Air. We also have updates to Apple Watch, so there's the Series 11, the SE 3, and the Ultra 3. And one of the things that I was most excited by was the launch of the AirPods Pro 3 with some really interesting new health features. We also got a bit more insight into iOS 26 featuring Apple Intelligence. We'll come back to that. But this event marked a bit of a shift in terms of Apple's messaging. There was less emphasis on the raw performance and more on design, health, and the ecosystem.
The new design has a larger 6.3-inch display with thinner borders, so you can see more and do more. And the display of iPhone 17 features ProMotion, just like our Pro models, with an adaptive refresh rate up to 120 hertz, designed to dynamically respond to your content for a smooth and power-efficient experience.
The iPhone 17 Air, we kind of knew it was coming, but it is worth focusing in on.
We are thrilled to introduce the impossibly thin iPhone Air. At 5.6 millimeters, it's the thinnest iPhone we've ever made, and it's also exceptionally light. It's unlike anything you've ever held before, and it's packed with our most advanced features. The gorgeous 6.5-inch display is our best, featuring ProMotion up to 120 hertz, always on, and 3,000 nits of peak brightness. And it's protected by the new Ceramic Shield 2, with improved anti-reflection and three times better scratch resistance than our previous Ceramic Shield. We're also bringing Ceramic Shield to the back of iPhone for the very first time. It's four times more resistant to cracks than our previous back glass. It also protects the new plateau that now houses major internal components at the top of iPhone.
It is Apple's thinnest phone ever. In terms of spec, here's the top line. It has a 6.6-inch Super Retina XDR display with 120 hertz refresh rate. There's a single 48 megapixel rear camera with a two optical zoom. Inside, you do have the new A19 Pro chip paired with 128 gigs of RAM. But the battery, the estimated battery goes from an estimated range of 2,800 milliamps to 3,200 milliamps. This phone is designed for portability and aesthetic appeal, but the trade-offs are clear. It is no question but a compromise. You have a reduced battery capacity, no ultra-wide or telephoto lenses, and there's uncertainty around the USB-C data speeds at the moment. This is a mid-tier device, but it's priced at, you ready? €1,239. with a hefty price tag and a middling spec sheet. Who is this for? Apple appears to be targeting a design-conscious consumer who wants a larger screen without the bulk of the Pro, but this is not a power user's phone. The Air is a statement in terms of its thinness and its design, but it is not a workhorse. Some people are saying that perhaps the iPhone 17 Air is a stepping stone on the road to a foldable phone from Apple. Perhaps that's what we'll get next year. But I would love to hear from you. If you are an Apple fan, would you be willing? Are you the person who would spend over €1,200 on a thin phone with a downgraded camera and a smaller battery? You can email me, techtalk@newstalk.com. Elsewhere at the launch, we got a pretty significant update to the AirPods in the form of the AirPods Pro 3.
AirPods Pro 3 deliver a breathtaking spatial listening experience. We designed a custom multi-port acoustic architecture, which precisely controls the airflow that carries sound into the ear. This transforms the bass response. It widens the sound stage so you hear every instrument and brings vocals into stunning focus across music, shows, and calls. And it gets even better with phenomenal active noise cancellation. Ultra low noise microphones and advanced computational audio combine with new foam infused ear tips for even greater noise isolation. This significantly improves performance, delivering twice the ANC compared to the previous generation, which were already amazing. Live translation powered by Apple Intelligence. Now, when you are together with someone who speaks a different language, like exploring a market abroad, AirPods Pro will help you understand them in your preferred language. Using a new simple gesture, live translation begins.
Translating Spanish.
While ANC lowers the volume of the person speaking, so it's easier to focus on the translation.
So the meaningful updates covered in that part of the event include the heart rate sensor, which is great if you are somebody who likes wearing your AirPods in the gym without a smartwatch. There's live translation powered by Apple Intelligence. There's improved active noise cancellation. The tips have also been enhanced, which is great. It has IP57 rating for sweat and water resistance, and up to 8 hours battery life with the active noise cancelling on. So very happy with all of that. There is no question, these are the most health aware earbuds yet. The heart rate sensor opens up new fitness integrations. The translation feature could be transformative for travel and accessibility. No flaws, no notes. They retail at around €289 here in Ireland, holding the same price point as the previous generation. But I don't know. This event was polished, but arguably incredibly conservative. The 17 Air is, in the eyes of some, a bold design move, but it doesn't push the boundaries in terms of functionality. The AirPods Pro 3 are impressive, further integrating health and AI in a way that feels genuinely useful. But I just walked away from the launch feeling a bit flat. On last week's show, we took a look back at Apple's story and the excitement and the buzz that existed right throughout the early part of their story. So from the first computers that we saw, the first Mac that we saw, the first iPod, the first iPhone, the innovation continued. Now we're seeing greater innovation from the likes of Honor, a brand that we didn't really know of up until recently enough. I would love to get your thoughts. What do you think is going to happen for Apple? Will this be a massive success? Or if you're an iPhone user, would you consider walking away and moving to Android? TechTalk@newstalk.com is the email address. I spoke to Ciara O'Brien of the Irish Times a little bit earlier and asked her for her reaction to the launch and if Apple has missed out on an opportunity for innovation.
I think all the smartphone companies are struggling with hardware innovation at the moment and have been for some time because you'll notice a lot of the smartphones look the same, but they do a lot of the same stuff. The hardware has advanced to such a point that you've kind of done most of what can be done with something that size, and it's very difficult to keep cramming more and more things in to try and make yourself stand out from the pack. So I think at this point now, we're looking at, this is why they're all turning to AI. Even if you look at some of the main innovations that Apple announced, so you've got the iPhone Air, which is super thin iPhone, you know, Samsung obviously had the S25 Edge. You've got live translate on the AirPods, which is a really interesting feature on the AirPods 3. And I'm very interested to try it out for myself rather than, you know, look at the pre-recorded demo. If that works the way it's supposed to, that could be really interesting because, you know, live translate is something that people would really get on board with. You know, it's a bit of a Star Trek kind of edge to it. It's also something that Google has been doing with the Pixel Buds as well. So, you know, it is quite difficult for companies at this point to stand out. Now, I've been kind of hearing stuff, obviously, about, you know, Apple maybe doing a folding phone, that this is kind of kicking off a three-year reinvention of the iPhone. But it's just so difficult to do something completely different with smartphones as they are now. And this is why we're seeing companies turning to AI. And obviously that's something that Apple has been a bit more cautious about for various reasons. You know, they want to safeguard privacy. They want to make sure that it's being done properly. But what I suppose it's meant is that, you know, companies like Google have kind of fired ahead with integrating AI throughout their entire ecosystem. And Apple has been that bit more cautious. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing because Apple has in the past shown that it doesn't have to be first. It just has to be better. So we'll see now over the next couple of years what will happen there.
I think it's difficult as well for companies to keep kind of coming up with these innovative products because the pressure is on, because Apple has come up with stuff like the iPad and the iPhone, because they've created these new categories of products in the past. There is the pressure there for them to keep on producing the goods. Like they've tried with the Vision Pro. There's been, you know, I suppose it depends on what side you fall on that. They've had some success with creating a demand for it, but, you know, has it managed to catch on to the general public? Well, it's a very expensive product at the moment. And I think people are watching to see what will come next. And we're always looking to see what will come next. However, we do have a very good kind of generation of mobile devices and people are hanging on to them for longer. It used to be the case where people would upgrade every year to a new phone. That replacement cycle has now lengthened to almost 3 years at this point, and now the companies are recognizing this because they support the phones for longer. And there is kind of pressure, I suppose, on them to do that because, you know, we do have a massive e-waste problem. There is an environmental toll to all these goods that they're producing. So, you know, they need to kind of manage that. And I think we're going to see more innovation on the software side of things. They will create, I suppose, the software and services that will go alongside this hardware that's fairly kind of mature now at this point. So we'll see what happens in the coming years.
Yeah, that was Ciara O'Brien of the Irish Times. Now, when we come back here on News Talk, I'm going to take you inside Aon's Centre for Innovation and Analytics.
Tech Talk on News Talk.
With Vodafone. Showcase your business at the Aviva this November with Vodafone's See Your Business Pitch Side Competition. See vodafone.ie/business.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk on Tuesday afternoon. I braved the rain and walked down to George's Quay here in Dublin to a very sleek looking glass building. Inside that tall glass building is the heart of Aon's Centre for Innovation and Analytics, where a team of people are working to redefine how global businesses understand and respond to risk. I went inside to meet the team to learn about the cutting-edge tools and technologies that are shaping decisions around everything from cyber threats and political instability to natural disasters.
Hi, Johnny McKenna. I work in Aon as Product Director.
So can you just start by introducing us to Aon? I'm sure a lot of people will recognise the name, mm-hmm. the logo, they'll have seen it around the place, but what do you actually do?
So Aon is one of the world's largest professional services company to provide advice on risk capital and human capital. So for anyone that would be insurance for commercial or, say, for example, health, wealth, pensions administration, all those sort of areas, we provide advice to number of companies across the globe, be that large multinationals through to small companies as well.
Okay, and for those of us who aren't necessarily in that world, mm-hmm. we're not talking about, you know, my salary and worrying about my house insurance. Mm-hmm. What kind of figures are we talking about here?
So typically when you think about commercial insurance, you're talking about large companies that have like maybe fleet of vehicles or of hundreds of vehicles or thousands of vehicles, or you think about it, have a property portfolio of hundreds or thousands of hotels across the globe. So the advice Aon brings to bear is around how to best manage the volatility and the risk of their properties. Say, for example, how do you best insure it and how do you best manage the risk against that as well? So we bring data from across the globe and different sources together to provide advice and insight that will help, you know, the client best manage that and ultimately decide how to best cover that from an insurance or risk management perspective.
So we're standing here in the gorgeous building in the heart of Dublin City Centre. Tell me a little bit about the types of people and the types of roles that exist in an organisation like this, because again, it's not an area that I'd ever thought about before.
So Aon itself, it's 50, 60,000 colleagues across the globe. Within Ireland here, we have 700 colleagues, of which we have 100 who are data analytics professionals. A mixture of product managers, actuaries, data scientists, web developers, data engineers, a variety of different skills and disciplines brought together to ultimately bring unstructured data to through a model or an algorithm to provide insights or advice to a colleague or a client, which would be typically appear as a web front end or a web portal or an API, for example, as well.
Mm. So we know that big businesses that need protection have existed for a long old time. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the word data there, and a lot of those job titles that you just listed off didn't exist 15, 20 years ago. Yeah. Before we talk through how things work today, how did it used to happen?
So insurance itself has always used data to help price and understand what's the volatility of it. Challenge in the past was this data existed in silos or in documents or didn't even exist in a structured format. So sometimes it's a little bit subjective, but ultimately what the roles here in Aon or in other companies would be to bring that data together, clean it, standardize it, make sense of it, and then ultimately use that to come up with a price or a method and so on. So it's always been used, but ultimately we're bringing more and more data to that conversation as well.
Mm. And I'm sure the integrity of the data as well is of vital importance. So does your team and the systems that you use have, you know, procedures in place to identify good data from bad data, relevant data from junk data and so on?
Yeah, so no different to any other company, a lot of the time is spent not just necessarily on deriving the insight, but sourcing and cleansing and processing the data. Aon invests a huge amount of time and money to make sure that we have high quality, high fidelity data that we can bring into our analytics so we can provide high quality advice. And the quality means different things to different people, but ultimately when you're thinking of analytics is the accuracy, the precision, the timeliness, and also the efficacy of that data so that we're using it and ultimately doing it in a fair, compliant, governed way.
Mm. And so once your team has taken all of that data in, what happens then?
So a lot of time we build data pipelines or connections to bring this data in from different parts of the globe or from different data sources. When we get it all together, we ultimately cleanse it, standardize it, and then run it through different models or different algorithms to come up with different insights. And then ultimately what insights is typically anchored on a client or a theme or a topic, which then we can use to sort of come up with either a prediction or a perspective around this is what needs to happen next as an action for that client. Either maybe the insurance programs need to change, maybe they need to look at, need to buy more, need to buy less, or indeed they need to think around how they best manage their risks. For example, if their buildings are in a location that is high frequency of flood or storm, what do you need to do to sort of mitigate that so that you're not incurring more and more claims over time?
Mm. And one thing that's interesting is that you could have two skyscrapers next door to each other, mm-hmm. right? Owned by two different people. Yeah. But I'm sure that their risks would be different based on either security guards, do people have card keys and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So it's not necessarily a one size fits all for every type of business. There will be variances and fluctuations.
Absolutely. So a lot of what we do when we're looking at is we get the characteristics of that client, and some of the characteristics will be common. So use the example of the two skyscrapers there. Same location, kind of same building type, probably same concrete or similar such as well. But then what you're looking to see, what's going to happen, what's the frequency and severity of that. In some cases, if it's a storm or a flood, both buildings will be impacted around it. But what that individual client does to manage around, do they have the right security? Do they have the right mitigations around that? that's where there's going to be a different outcome as such as well. So that's where Aon can provide a lot of advice around risk engineering, around how to best manage that, but also advise, okay, what should you do next when these things do happen as well.
And one of the things that I always love playing around with is, you know, probability and possibility. I just think it's a fascinating concept, but when you're talking about millions or billions of dollars, it's not a fun little game that you do on the Lewis home to entertain yourself. It's, you know, very, very serious business. How do you guys go about developing that analysis, or not even developing it, but also articulating it to the decision makers when it is such high value?
So in a lot of cases, we work very closely with business SMEs across the globe who have been maybe in that case located in New York or whatever that location is. We work very closely here with a multidisciplinary team that has the right different skill sets to bring to bear, to bring all that data together, to answer those type of questions, but then ultimately present those findings back to the client or the colleague in an accessible, intuitive way. So we invest a lot on customer experience, user interface design, as well as on the analytics as such, so that we can say, this is what we found, this is what we know, this is what we don't know, of course, which is an important part of it, and also what was the method around how we came up with those outputs and advice as well. So there's lots of different steps in that, but ultimately we're working backward from what's the question the client is interested in, and also what's the actions we can provide advice on as well.
You mentioned there what we don't know, and that leads us nicely to the world of cyber attack and cyber security. The most famous example, which we always refer on this program, is what happened at the HSE. We saw the impact that that had, not only in the moment, but also in the aftermath. We also have figures around the costs of that. This is something that I think we here in Ireland are finally sitting up straight about. Is it possible to apply the same methodology that you would for buildings when it comes to cyber infrastructure?
Yeah, I would say cyber is a growing area, and the awareness, and also cyber as an industry or these things, is only in the last 10, 15 years becoming more pertinent or more awareness as such. We absolutely provide advice, products and service to advise clients in this area. So obviously cyber insurance is an emerging and growing insurance area. Second part of it, we provide advice around, say, for example, how to best manage that risk. So you think about it in your IT environments, is your environment, is your infrastructure up to date? Is your security done the correct way? How do you manage your infrastructure? Do you know how it looks? Do you, how you're going to manage it as such? All those things can be brought to bear. We bring that information in and then ultimately can provide advice around, this is what you need to do to improve your cyber resilience, it's called. So that's sort of like, as in a lot of cases, there's a lot of stuff you can do to mitigate, but sometimes these things will happen afterwards. There could be a ransomware attack, or there could be some bad actor out there as such. So the next step is, okay, how do you react to it? And ultimately, that's a big part of your resilience. How quickly can you react to it? Do you have the ability to quarantine what's happened? Do you know how you have resilience around how you store and manage your data? How secure is it? How encrypted? So a lot of those questions can be brought to bear, which means not necessarily you're talking about it from cyber as insurance, but ultimately your IT security and what do you need to invest into the future as well.
So one of the questions that I often get on the show from SMEs is, you know, budgets are tight. We're having to make changes to X, Y, and Z. Do we really need to invest as much in terms of software updates or assessing approved vendors, all that kind of stuff? But from an insurance point of view, I'm assuming they're the questions that you guys ask to come up with your figures.
Absolutely. So you think about how you sort of predict or price things, what people look for is, okay, where is there a weakness? And the weakness in most cases, maybe your IT is not up to date. You have issues in certain areas as well. So yes, there is a cost in the investment this, but it has to be tapered around or factored into what's the cost if something did go wrong and how do you mitigate across these as well. So, and also the advice we can provide is, okay, what's the actions you can take to sort of make sure that you're maximizing your investment in this area, so that in some cases you have the right coverage, or in other cases there is investment you need to make in your core IT systems as well.
And so as a whole, because I know you said before you we started recording, you've been here for a long time now. Is AI going to be the biggest disruptor in your career time in terms of kicking things on? Or has there been another moment or movement in this field over that period that has caused as dramatic a shift as what we're going through at the moment?
I would say, generative AI has been a huge disruptor over the last 2 years as such. AI itself and statistical modeling and all the different machine learning and all those things, they've been available for a long time as such. But I think what's the change now is the speed of transformation. And I think that's going to continue to increase into the future. So there's huge opportunity coming with that, huge risk comes with it as well. And I think for a lot of people, it's trying to understand, what do I do and where do I go next as such as well. But for us, the volume of data that's now accessible to us to provide insights and advice is growing, which is incredibly exciting for us here in the team in Dublin.
And in terms of the generative AI side of things, you could see and imagine how beneficial it would be. But also from your team's point of view, when they are at that data collation stage, is there a threat because there's so much junk out there now because of generative AI? There's that whole AI slop. We also know that documents, you know, internally and externally can be produced without a ton of effort. That can add a bit of noise.
Absolutely. So a lot of what we invest in is in the quality of our own data so that we can use it to bring the right insights as well. We also apply AI to clean data, to check data, to validate it's correct and further enrich it as such. So that's where we see a lot of the controls, the safeguards around what we want to bring to bear, so that when actually it comes into actually how we run our models or how we provide our advice, we have a high degree of comfort and confidence that we are using the right and valuable data as such. And ultimately, that's what we have within our own systems, is that controls and safeguards. Different story, obviously, if you're going onto the internet and you're trying to find out something, that's a very different. But when you're thinking you're leveraging a large professional service company such as Aon, that's where the investment is, to make sure that we have high quality data to make sure that we can provide the right insights here as well.
So I'm Martin McGovern and I'm the Global Head of Emerging Risk Analytics at Aon.
So just tell me a little bit about what your day-to-day is.
Yeah, so I suppose Aon is at the forefront of the risk landscape, right? So it's important that we're able to advise clients not only on existing risks, but on the next risk around the corner. So we're always exploring new ways of trying to get more data and more insights, not only on those risks like cyber or your property, but what's around the corner, AI misuse, AI copyright infringement, supply chain failure, geopolitical tensions. The issue there is that there isn't the same quantity and volume of data available to model them. So it's important that we have new and innovative ways to solve that problem. And that's what I focus on. Anyhow.
And so how, where and why does AI fit into that picture?
So I suppose it comes back to the data question, because you don't have your claims and loss data like you might have for your cyber or your property. So in lieu of that, you have to try and find new data in new areas. The issue there is that they're often unstructured and noisy data sources, because it could be global media, it could be unstructured PDFs and Excels that were previously very hard to analyze at scale. And so we try and utilize AI in multiple different ways, especially generative AI, to translate that unstructured, noisy data into a coherent source of risk intelligence, especially for these new risks like geopolitical tension, tariffs, etc., where you can't really rely on previous claims data.
And so is this the platforms that the average punter is using, or is the, are these platforms that have been built and constantly tweaked and enhanced by your own team?
So that's a really good question. It's actually patent pending on our side. So we're really proud of the fact that it's really innovative and unique to Aon, and something that we can offer clients in a very, very unique manner. So for example, we're currently offering the ability for clients to give us a list of their peers, and we look at all their risk events in the media, and we say what risk events are happening all around them that have happened to companies very similar to themselves that might happen to them next. So it's almost a way of risk discovery by proxy. So it's happened to, you know, this huge technology company, it might happen to you next. Do you want to mitigate against it or prepare for it in some way? You mightn't be able to transfer it as such because insurance mightn't exist because it's an emerging risk, AI misuse, etc. But at least you can see what other companies have done in the past and what worked best for them.
You mentioned emerging risk there, and that is something that intrigues me. How does something become a risk rather than an emerging risk? How often does it have to happen? How impactful does it need to be?
It's a great question. So it speaks to the maturity of the risk. So initially, they might surface, you know, inadvertently by one event every year or one event every so often. But as it becomes more endemic and more systemic in its impact, it matures not only in what we understand of it, but also how we can mitigate against it. So we measured the maturity of the risk, as in how much data do you have on it? How complex can you do the modeling to understand when and where it might happen? And also then in the advice and the mitigation perspective of what the client might be able to do to mitigate against it. Mm-hmm. So as the risk becomes more and more mature, more and more different services and crisis management products become available to mitigate against that risk. And that's how it becomes a mature risk rather than an emerging threat as such.
Okay. And so does that mean that part of this is analysing what's emerging or bubbling under the surface in various parts of the world? Because I know from reporting on it, you know, cyber threats might emerge in Asia 18 months before they happen here in Europe, or even longer. So are you guys constantly having, you know, your ear to the ground all over the world?
100%. So we have over 80,000 data sources in 200 countries, multi-language in terms of media. We check it all through a human in the loop, very important whenever you're using generative AI especially. But because of that huge global coverage, we can allow for that time delay between an event happening in APAC versus EMEA versus US, and how we can have that advanced warning system almost to notify clients of what's around the corner. And they love that, whether it's for their peer group, like I mentioned, in terms of risk discovery by proxy, or even in your supply chain. So they can give us a list of their 200 most important suppliers, and we can look what risks have happened to them, you know, whether it be in Asia or whether it be in the US or whatever, and advise them before it hits their own doorstep, you know, in terms of their own frontline services.
Mm. And so are you now seeing and hearing customers and businesses coming in with new risks or new worries on their list because of things like generative AI, also their employees' eagerness to use it versus training and compliance and all that side of things as well?
It's really fascinating because there's all these different new risks coming in from different areas. Mm. But you speak to a very good one in terms of AI misuse and infringement of copyright and all these risks that come bundled with it. And another good example is cyber, actually, because cyber is quote kind of insurable, but there's always components that are uninsurable, right? So they're either excluded from policies or they're not even aware of them yet, because it could be AI deep fake attacks. It could be AI misuse and data leakage by using a public AI model, etc. So I suppose AI falls into the realms of cyber risk in a lot of ways, but it's a very new vector on the cyber risk landscape that can have huge impact not only on the existing policies, but also on your new exposures going forward as more and more of your colleagues use the generative AI tools.
It's just bananas. So in terms of what you're doing, because we've had some very heavy conversations over the last 2 years about generative AI and the fear factor and the doom and gloom factor, but am I right in saying that this type of technology is of great benefit to your sector and your industry in terms of not only the integrity of the work, but also the speed of the processing of the work?
100%. It makes data that was previously inaccessible accessible. Mm. But we're very cognizant of data quality and trust in your insights. Mm. So that's where the human in the loop is absolutely vital. So, for example, if we extract data from the media, we have a team of analysts that assess every single event to make sure it's a valid event. So for that two-tiered approach of using the cutting-edge technology whilst maintaining data standards means you get the best of both worlds. You get the new innovation without the risk of inadvertent insights or loss of confidence in your product as such.
Yeah, a huge thanks to the team at Aon for letting me into their very swanky offices and explaining how that side of things works. It's genuinely something I'd never thought about, but it was fascinating to see the dashboard of their platform, to see, I suppose, based on how much risk you're willing to take on, how that fluctuates and impacts the premiums that you pay. It's just, I don't know, mind-boggling, I think is the term. But a huge thanks indeed to the team for having me in. Elsewhere this week, we finally got the traditional bank's response to Revolut. Revolut, which has around 3 million customers in this country now, transformed day-to-day banking. Many of us use it to split bills, to save money. They're looking at mortgages. There's crypto. There's everything within the app now. I'm a huge fan and I've used it for a long time. But this week, we got a little glimpse at Zip Pay, which is going to be available to customers of Bank of Ireland, AIB and PTSB to begin with. And it'll essentially allow you to send payments instantly, regardless of the bank, of the person that you're sending the money to. Because at the moment, if I wanted to send you money as a Bank of Ireland customer and you're an AIB customer, it may not show up instantaneously. And that is where sort of Revolut really did shake things up. They're saying that Zip Pay will launch early next year. It will be an opt-out thing. So if you are a customer of Bank of Ireland, AIB or PTSB, you'll be automatically enrolled to have this feature. If you don't want this feature, you can opt out. As I say, it'll be interesting to see how it goes down. If it does make an impact and put a dent in the number of people using Revolut day to day, I have started over the last while now to use Revolut for my day-to-day banking. My Bank of Ireland account is still there. My salary goes into it. All my payments go into it. But then I pay myself into my Revolut. I have savings for Revolut. So I have my rainy day saver account. I have a Christmas savings account. I have the spare change thing totted up. So I'm constantly using it as my main driver for banking day to day. But I'd love to know what your thoughts are. Is this too little too late from the traditional banks? Has anyone moved away from a traditional bank entirely to just use Revolut? You can email me techtalk@newstalk.com. And speaking of that email address, when we come back here on News Talk, I'll answer your tech questions.
Tech Talk on News Talk.
With Vodafone. Showcase your business at the Aviva this November with Vodafone's See Your Business Pitch Side Competition. See vodafone.ie/business.
Now, last week on the show, we spoke with Alex Cooney of CyberSafe Kids, who talked us through some of the results of their annual survey. There were some really interesting takeaways, including the positive impact parents are having. We saw a drop in the number of children with smartphones, which is great. But we also got insight into the number of Irish children using AI. This is an area that still needs to be addressed in terms of education and safeguards, as well as platform-based protections. An Irish company called Olus Education has compiled a free AI toolkit for schools, which gives teachers ready-to-use resources such as quick reference do's and don'ts cards, parental consent letter templates, and policy-aligned templates. The idea is that this toolkit will help schools embrace AI in education, but in a way that protects students' data. It is fully compliant and ensures that AI is supporting the learning rather than replacing the education. If you are a teacher or a principal, you can find out more information on Olus, so it's olus.education. And I want to stick with the area of digital education and online safety, because Nick Clegg, who worked alongside Mark Zuckerberg and other senior executives at Meta for 7 years, sat down with Emily Maitlis on the News Agents podcast. He was there to talk about his new book, How to Save the Internet. And there is one snippet in particular that stood out to me. Take a listen.
Reading the book, it seems like there is genuine ambiguity in your mind.
In my mind.
About the dangers of screen time, the dangers of Facebook, the dangers of Instagram for young people. You say how much we think we know about how corrosive screen time is to mental health. The data looks murkier and more ambiguous than headlines suggest. Mm. And yet during your time at Facebook, you saw how concerned the public was. You saw how concerned parents, even your own colleagues, were about this issue. A lawsuit you'll be familiar with called the Tennessee case, filed by 45 states accusing Meta of unfairly snaring teenagers and children on Meta products whilst deceiving the public about the hazards. You knew all this was going on, and yet you've come away saying, oh, I think the data's a bit ambiguous.
I think the data is ambiguous. I mean, I know, of course, people don't like dealing with ambiguity, but if you look at the research from a succession of academics, all of which I cite in the book, and it's not me saying this, I really do try and as dispassionately as possible for the reader, because this is a highly emotive topic. Mm. You're dealing with parents who are anxious about their kids. What are they doing on online? You're dealing, obviously, with some horrific and tragic cases of teens who've
deaths.
Taken their own lives and so on. So I try and just very dispassionately say, this is what the evidence in terms of claim and counterclaim seems to suggest. Where I come out is, even if the evidence is much more ambivalent than I think some of the assertions suggest. In fact, there's a lot of evidence that suggests that societally, so I cannot stress enough, I'm talking now about big numbers, not about individual cases. You're always going to find individual cases where people are exposed to content they shouldn't be. But societally, the evidence is, if you look at the work, for instance, of Professor Andrew Przylski in Oxford, the Oxford Internet Institute, who's done one of the biggest longitudinal study of the relationship between the use of social media and mental well-being amongst teens and so on, it just doesn't show some great causal link, much as people would want to. Having said all of that, where I come out is, it almost kind of doesn't matter what you think the data shows. You should take a precautionary approach. That's what I did at Facebook. I successfully pushed for and introduced a whole raft of measures which didn't exist when I arrived at the company, including now defaulting teens around the world in their hundreds of millions into much more protective, what are called teens.
Yeah, that is Nick Clegg speaking with Emily Maitlis on the News Agents podcast. I'd highly recommend you take a listen to the entire interview because you get some really interesting insights into the mentality of those working for social media giants. And you'll find it wherever you get your podcasts. Yeah, that is the theme tune to the show that has fast become my latest obsession, and that is Taskmaster. I kept seeing little snippets of it on Instagram, so I started watching it on Netflix last weekend, and oh my days, it is so good. It is pure joy and nonsense in the very best way possible. If you haven't watched it, I would highly recommend. The new series kicked off on Channel 4 last Thursday, so you can catch up on the Channel 4 player if you missed it. But there are a ton of series up on Netflix. So if you're looking for something fun to watch, that is my recommendation of the week. Taskmaster, get on it. But as ever, I'm open to your suggestions and recommendations. You can email me techtalk@newstalk.com. And speaking of the email, let's jump into the inbox and answer your questions. First up, we have an email here from John in Terranure who says, what is your recommendation to replace an old Galaxy A52 5G phone? I was very happy with the old phone as recommended by you a few years ago, but need to replace it soon. Any advice greatly appreciated. Yes, if you're ready to move on from your A52 5G, there are some solid devices out there that would be similar but much improved on that phone. So the first one on my list would be the Galaxy A55. So it's sort of a natural successor to the phone that you have now, but better performance, better camera, better battery. It's around €379, but it will last you a good while. The other one, or the other option that you could go for if you wanted to stick with Samsung and you wanted something slightly more powerful, would be an S23 FE. Or a refurbished S23. Again, it would be the flagship from a few years ago, so very powerful, very great, like very fast processor and a great camera. It would cost a little bit more, but if you wanted a serious upgrade in terms of the performance, that would be the way to go. Next, we have an email here from Dave who says, hi Jess, do you know, is Apple Family Setup available in Ireland? I'm looking to get my two kids an Apple Watch that I can pair to my iPhone as they don't have one yet as they're too young. I currently use an Explorer watch, but they've outgrown it and they're not old enough for a phone yet. The Apple website says it's not available in Ireland. CompuB have assured me it is available through Vodafone eSIM, and Vodafone has told me it's not available. Any advice would be appreciated. Okay, you are dead right to be confused. This is a bit of a maze, but I've broken it down and I think this is all as clear as I can make it anyway. So Apple's family setup, often called Apple Watch for your kids, allows you to pair an Apple Watch to your iPhone for a child who doesn't have a phone of their own. It's a brilliant idea. It's a great way for tracking the location and setting limits and all the rest. However, from my research, it is not available. Family setup is not available in Ireland. That means that you can't use the full suite of features designed for managing a kid's watch independently from your phone. Vodafone Ireland does support eSIM for Apple Watch. They were the first in the country to do it, and that's likely what CompuBe is referring to. But here is the catch. Vodafone eSIM support is for pairing your Apple Watch to your phone, not for family setup. Family setup requires the watch to have its own cellular plan separate from the iPhone, which Vodafone Ireland currently doesn't support for children's watches. So while you can get an Apple Watch with cellular to your, for yourself, essentially, you can't get it independently for your kids. So if, as you say, your kids have outgrown the Explorer, but they're not ready for phones, here's what you could do. You could look at a brand outside of the Apple ecosystem. So look at something like the Garmin or Fitbit devices. They have GPS-enabled watches that would be perfect for tracking the kids' location and basic messaging, but doesn't require them to have a separate phone. So I hope that helps. It was a bit of a tricky one, that, but as I said, I did my best to try and make it as clear as possible. If you have any queries for me, or if you're looking for recommendations for anything at all, you can drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com. But that's it from me this week. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back in full on the Go Loud app. I'll be back with Shane and Kira on Monday's Newstalk Breakfast. But in the meantime, have a great weekend.